Hello, and welcome to Cricket and England Through Five Matches. In this series of podcasts, we will be examining aspects of English culture, society and history in the early 20th century, and in each episode, we'll be doing so by looking at a single cricket match. Each match has been chosen because, well, mainly they were cracking games of cricket featuring some of the greatest players of the English game which deserve to be revisited, but also because either the matches themselves, or the circumstances within which they were played, tell us something of England and how the game of cricket reflected, influenced or resisted the changes which were taking place in this period. To come later in the series, we'll look at the rush to war in 1914, the long recovery after the armistice, we'll consider the British Empire and attitudes towards race, and then the descent once more into war in 1939. But now, in episode one, we look at the question of class in England at the end of the Victorian era. And to do that, we're going to visit Lord's Cricket Ground in July of 1900 for the Gentlemen versus Players fixture. And what a match it was. We hope you enjoy.
He calls me his own Grace Darling, sung by Mr. Edward M. Paymore. Sonophone record. I feel just as happy as a girl can be, upon my word it's true. I'm so very happy that I don't know which or what I'm going to do.
As the 19th century gave way to the 20th, Britain stood on the cusp of great change. Literally and figuratively, Victorian Britain was coming to an end. In July of 1900, Queen Victoria had entered what would be the last 6 months of her 63-year reign. Her British Empire would continue to expand over the next two decades, but by the time it began its inevitable decline, events at home would have moved on apace. The advent of universal male suffrage, votes for many, though not yet all, women, the rise of the mass trade union movement, the last Liberal government and the first of the Labour Party, and the assertion of the power of the People's House of Commons over the aristocratic House of Lords. It was as if the very foundations of the British class system were under attack. The whole concept of the separation of society into classes and the question of how to maintain those divisions was of great salience during the Victorian era. It had become a highly significant political and social issue because, for many, the class system seemed under threat. From the end of the 18th century, social tides appeared to be shifting. The French Revolution served as a warning signal to the British elite, a portent of the threat that their own lower and middle classes might pose to the existing hierarchy. This threat looked to be very real during the early 19th century, with agitation from the lower classes highlighted by incidents including the Peterloo Massacre of 1819 and the rise of reforming movements such as the Anti-Corn Law League and the Chartists. Whether this threat was indeed real was not the point. Many in the political and social elite thought it was, and believed that the British class system needed to be actively defended both at home and in the colonies. The resulting defence of hierarchy took two main forms. The first was political reform, including the Great Reform Acts of 1832, 1867 and 1884, designed to placate the lower classes by bringing their grievances within the system. The second was the strengthening of the formal and informal norms of class. During the mid to late 19th century, the language of class and hierarchy was ubiquitous, and the majority of institutions, from the armed forces to education, were strictly organised on class lines. Increasingly, the Victorian people explicitly viewed society in terms of class structures and, for those at the top of the structure at least, felt a great duty to protect them. Nowhere were these norms exemplified better than in cricket. It is true that the cricket field was of note during the 19th century in providing a sporting arena where labourer could compete with lord, miner with medic, blacksmith with businessman. Any suggestion, however, that the mixing of the classes on the field of play blurred the boundaries of status was far from the mark, because of, rather than despite, the cross-class interaction on the field. Care was taken that norms of social stratification were preserved once stumps had been drawn. In first-class cricket especially, the class boundaries were formally and clearly enforced, no more so than in the classification of cricketers as either amateur or professional, or, in cricketing parlance, as gentlemen and players. There was an irony that while cricket, and indeed society, sought to divide the population into distinct classes, lords and commoners, officers and enlisted men, gentlemen and players, the reality of class was far more complicated. Where did the class boundaries lie? It was not always wealth. As the 19th century drew to a close, class and riches had often gone their separate ways, with many established families struggling to maintain their way of life while middle-class businesses flourished. Was it education? What impact did one's parents' backgrounds have when the children of factory owners could rub shoulders with trainee aristocrats in Britain's public schools? There was a general perception of a three-tier system with working, middle and upper classes. However, the reality was that social standing varied widely depending on the social context. It was a complex social structure attempting to appear simple. Ultimately, a person's place in this class system rested on perception. As the author David Cannadine argued, the only sure way of knowing you were a gentleman was to be treated as such. In that observation lay the essence of the amateur-professional divide in cricket. Amateurism was not the preserve of the independently wealthy or landed gentry. Many amateurs needed to earn their keep in other jobs. The distinction was more one of class and the perceptions of class. At a basic level, the difference between the two cricketing classes was one of payment. Professionals were paid to play the game, whereas the amateurs were not. Those many amateurs who needed to work to sustain themselves financially were, of course, limited to those professions that would allow them to regularly turn out for their county or other side. For a manual labourer, this would not be an option, so professionalism was the only route for the talented working-class cricketer. However, the perception of what differentiated an amateur and a professional ran much deeper than simply the ability of a man to pay their own way. The gentleman was seen as the embodiment of the spirit of the game, playing for the love of the sport rather than for recompense. In some quarters, there was a certain hostility towards the idea of professionalism in sport. Cricket was leisure, not labour, to be played for its own noble ends and not to earn a living. The suspicion was that professionals were mercenaries without the unpaid loyalty to their side that the amateurs possessed, and as such, rules were introduced in 1873 to restrict the movement of players between counties. As befitted their higher status, the amateurs enjoyed privileges denied their professional colleagues. They changed in better rooms, drank in different bars, ate superior food at lunch, and travelled in more comfortable style. The scorecard also served as a reminder of the class distinction. Amateurs were listed with title and initials preceding their surnames. Professionals were afforded no title. Often their initials followed their surname, and occasionally were referred to by last name alone. Of course, only an amateur was normally allowed to captain a county or international team. Although a good county professional could earn more than twice what he would as a labourer, a cricket career was no route to riches, and everywhere one looked, the professional was reminded of his secondary status. Even on the field of play, the class distinction was expected to be upheld. The amateurs were viewed as the artists of the game, whereas the professionals were the workmen and were often expected to fit that mould. On one notable occasion, the talented Sussex professional Joe Vine hit three flowing boundaries in an over. According to Vine, his captain, the amateur C.B. Fry, marched down the wicket to sharply remind him that Vine's job was to stay there and leave that sort of batting to him. The relationship between the cricketing classes and the extent to which formalities were to be observed also could fluctuate, within acceptable boundaries, of course, depending on context. The Middlesex professional Harry Lee told of a time he was hauled in front of Lord Harris, treasurer of the MCC and a stickler for the laws of the game, to answer for a perceived indiscretion in a recent match against Kent. Harry answered the charge in a diplomatic manner, something which seemed just to irk Harris further. Lee was saved by the intervention of the Middlesex president, Alexander Webb, who said it was a very good answer and followed up by exclaiming, "I see exactly what you mean, Harry." In Harry Lee's telling of the story, Lord Harris's eyebrows rose as dangerously as a short bumper on a fast wicket. "Harry?" he said. "Harry? Oh, why, yes," said Mr. Webb. "Harry is one of our men." "Oh, very well," said Lord Harris, who seemed to feel that discipline had been strained to its limits. "Very well, Lee, that will do." According to Harry Lee, even Harris's on-parade attitude to professionals would soften somewhat when it concerned cricketers from his own county of Kent. As much in the class system by this time, appearances mattered more than reality. It was not uncommon for amateurs to make a living from the game without facing the ignominy of turning professional. For the most talented amateurs, salaried administrative posts could be conjured within their cricket club. Expenses, which only amateurs were permitted to claim, could be inflated. Products could be endorsed and advertised, all which allowed them to secure an income from the game while not, officially, being paid to play. Such shamateurism, as it became known, was an open secret, and accusations of professionalism were levelled at some of the game's biggest amateur names. Monday, 16th of July, 1900. Buried on page 13 of that morning's Times newspaper was a notice alerting readers to the commencement of the latest instalment of the Clearis exhibition, indeed celebration, of the cricketing class system, the prestigious Gentlemen vs. Players contest, a series of fixtures that had, by the late 19th century, established itself alongside the North vs. South match as one of the most important of the season. Especially so in years such as 1900, where a lack of a touring international team meant there were no test matches for the paying public to attend. Three matches were scheduled for 1900. The first had been held at the Oval in early July and had seen the players run out winners by 37 runs. The final match was to be played at Scarborough at the end of August. It would result in a comfortable innings victory for the professionals. The second fixture, however, described by Wisden as certainly the most remarkable game of the whole season, is the one of greatest interest. Held at Lord's, the home of cricket, over three sweltering days, the temperature gauge in London would peak at 92 degrees Fahrenheit. It produced a remarkable finish, exhibited the skills of some of the finest players of their generation, and was significant for the absence of cricket's greatest figure. William Gilbert Grace, cricket's first superstar, dominated the Victorian game in a way that, perhaps Bradman aside, it is hard to find comparison in the modern world. He personified the sport, and nothing was more closely associated with him as the Gentlemen versus Players fixture. The contest between the leading amateurs and professionals of the day had originated in 1806, but did not become an annual fixture until 1819. In its early days, the matches struggled for credibility. Aware that they were no match for the fitter and generally more skilled professionals, the gentlemen took often extraordinary measures to avoid defeat. Early gentlemen teams would feature given men, two of the best players from the professional ranks co-opted to strengthen the amateur side. Several matches saw the size of the gentlemen's ranks inflated as they were allowed to field extra men, once in 1868, as many as 20. In 1821, the amateur side took the unusual step of simply giving up on the second day of play, rather than plough on to certain defeat. And, most bizarrely, in 1832, the gentlemen reduced the size of their wicket, while, in 1837, they required the players to increase theirs by defending four stumps. Results had swung in favour of both teams during the 1820s, but in the next decade, despite the machinations of the amateurs, the professionals gained full control. Between 1830 and 1841, the gentlemen managed only two drawn matches and a solitary victory. The emergence of some strong amateur players, Alfred Min and Nicholas Felix particularly, saw parity return for the 1840s, but in the next decades, the professionals re-established their dominance and took 22 of the 24 games played between 1850 and 1864. W.G. Grace's selection for the gentlemen in 1865 was crucial in turning the fortunes their way. While his first experience in their ranks was a heavy 118-run defeat at the Oval, the next, at Lord's, saw an 8-wicket victory for the amateur side, largely thanks to the wicket-taking abilities of his brother, E.M. Grace. While no one-man team, the importance of WG to the resurgence of the gentlemen cannot be overstated. Over the following incredible 41 years, he played in the fixture 85 times, captaining the gentlemen on at least 41 occasions, scored 6,008 runs at an average of 42.6, including 15 centuries, two double centuries, and he took 271 wickets. A truly remarkable run that included some equally remarkable performances. On the morning of July 16th, however, Grace was conspicuous by his absence. While he had missed the occasional match before, and would participate in the fixture sporadically over the following 6 years, his omission marked the second step into the twilight of his long and distinguished career. The first was his retirement from Test cricket the year before. This was the first time in 35 years that he had not been selected for the gentlemen when available. He had not missed the Lord's fixture in that time, and the champion would never play for the amateurs at the home of cricket again. If Britain was witnessing the final days of one of its greatest monarchs, the game of cricket was doing the same. The crowd that gathered at Lord's on that morning appeared slightly down on previous years, but an estimated 10,000 people still crammed into the newly constructed mound stand and surrounds. The pavilion was, of course, reserved for members only. Expectation of a player's win were high. The dominance of the gentlemen in the late 1860s and throughout the 1870s was a distant memory, While both sides had tasted victory in the years since, the Players had been the more successful team, and in July of 1900 were widely considered to have the stronger side. Indeed, the depth of talent within the professional ranks was such that 22 different men represented the Players that summer, with no noticeable change in the strength of the team. The Gentlemen, while fielding some highly able cricketers, were missing some obvious names. Along with the absent Grace, the team sheet was lacking the talents of men such as K.S. Ranjit Singhji and Archie MacLaren, two outstanding batsmen. However, despite these omissions and the expectation that the Players would ultimately prevail, hopes of an entertaining contest were raised by the prospect of some highly rated cricketers in the amateur ranks, in particular C.B. Fry and debutant Tip Foster. As the crowd continued to file in, the two captains met for the toss. The Players, represented by the popular Governor Bobby Abel, and the Gentlemen by the Australian-born Sammy Woods. Woods won the toss and elected to bat. Both Abel and Woods were talented and well-liked cricketers, with plenty of first-class experience under their belts. Their careers, Abel for Surrey and England, Woods for Somerset, Australia and England, crossed on many occasions, but their different experiences in the world of cricket reflected the gulf between the sporting lives of amateur and professional. In 1881, at the age of 23, Rotherhithe-born Robert Abel, better known as Bobby, left his job as a warehouseman to make his first-class debut for Surrey, having lied about his age to be accepted as a young Surrey colt earlier that year. His batting career got off to a slow start, with single-digit averages in his first two seasons with the county, but his timing was fortuitous as, at the end of Bobby's second season, Surrey began to rethink its approach to developing its professionals. As a result, the county expanded its fixture list to give the professionals more chance to gain playing experience, rather than expecting them to regularly drop in and out of the side to accommodate the whims of their amateur colleagues. Bobby appeared to benefit from the increased match time, and soon established himself as a firm crowd favourite at the Oval. Being the local lad helped his popularity, as also did his small stature, measuring 5'5", lending him an air of a David fearlessly battling the bowling Goliaths of the county circuit. An opening batsman who played skillfully to the off and leg side, albeit with a slightly crossed bat, he passed 1,000 runs for a season for the first time in 1886, and again in 1888, 1889, 1891, and 1892. It was relatively late in his career, though, that Abel had his greatest success, passing 2,000 runs in every season from 1895 to 1902. It was no surprise that he had been invited to captain the Players, as in 1900, although 42 years old, he was clearly just reaching the peak of his powers. In that 1900 season, he would set a new English record by hitting 12 first-class centuries. The following year, Abel would pass 3,000 runs. C.B. Fry was impressed enough by the Surrey opener to include him in his 1899 text, Giants of the Game, hailing an Abel who gathers runs like blackberries everywhere he goes. Abel made his England debut in 1888 at Lord's in a match that most of England would rather forget. Their opponent, Australia, won the toss and made the best of a bad pitch by posting 116 in their first innings. Neither side would come close to that total again, and England, having collapsed to 53 all out in their first innings, failed to chase a modest target in their second, succumbing with the score on 62. For Abel, scores of 3 and 8 made his debut an unhappy one. He would fare much better in the next test. Someone leaving with much happier memories of that match was another debutant, wearing Australian colours for the first time, S.M.J. Woods. Sammy Woods was a genial man from New South Wales, as large as Abel was small, but just as popular. W.G. Grace described him as a giant in size, in strength and in pluck. He was also an all-round sportsman, excelling at a range of activities, including football, hockey, boxing, golf, and particularly rugby, for which he was captain by England 13 times, 5 as captain. Cricket, though, was his main pursuit, and he found a welcome home at Somerset, whom he would captain with distinction for 13 seasons from 1894. Initially a fearsome fast bowler, he was named by Wisden as one of their 6 great bowlers of the year in 1889. He earned the respect of his team by putting in the hard overs that amateur captains would often leave to the professionals. By the time of the Lord's match of 1900, however, his deliveries had lost much of their speed and potency. Such was his ability, though, as his bowling declined, and he was still capable enough in that regard, his batsmanship improved, and when he was appointed for the first time captain of the gentlemen for this fixture, he was considered a genuine all-rounder. Sammy Woods was also present at Bobby Able's greatest moment as a cricketer. In 1899, at the Oval, while facing a Somerset team led by Woods, Able batted for 8.5 hours, carrying his bat for an individual score of 357. At the time, it was the second highest score ever made in first-class cricket. It remains the sixth highest made in England and the fifth highest by an Englishman. And as a reward, the Oval crowd collected £33 for their hero. The Surrey board were less generous, awarding talent money of £5. There, in how each was paid, lay the heart of the difference between the experience of these two rival captains, and later friends. For both made their living from cricket, but in very different ways. Bobby, as a professional, would have been paid per match, with a little extra for a win, earn a small summer wage as a ground bowler, practice fodder for the amateur batsman, occasional talent money, collections at the ground, and, for the longer serving, a benefit game. For the professional, an injury or run of poor form could be a financial disaster, and, for most, all payments ceased at the end of the cricket season, although Able was one of a fortunate few that Surrey, from 1892, offered winter employment to, which allowed him to stop returning to the warehouse at the end of each season. We do not know exactly how much money Able would have collected from cricket in a year, but it is estimated that, by the end of the 19th century, a good county pro, with international recognition, could earn over £200. Sammy Woods also earned that amount a year from cricket, except as an amateur. No warehouse man he. Woods had come to England at the age of 16 to be educated at first Brighton College and subsequently Cambridge. Needing work to sustain him, Woods attempted a career in banking, but possessed neither the aptitude nor enthusiasm for it. Once installed as Somerset's captain, there was some fear at the county that financial considerations would mean a return to Australia for their new leader. The solution was found in the offer of the position of joint secretary, with an annual salary of £200. Such was the sham of amateurism in some cases, for Sammy Woods was no full or even part-time administrator. He was, in effect, being paid so he could play cricket. This, though, was not to mean that the Somerset captain and Able were on a financial par. While their income may have been similar, Able was expected to pay for all his travel and accommodation out of his own pocket, which could consume over half his pay, whereas Woods, as an amateur, could claim those on expenses. One was also on a salary, which meant that any periods of injury were covered. The other was paid on a per-match basis, and Bobby Able was fortunate when the Surrey board offered him half pay for the occasional period of absence. Of course, amateurism also brought with it many other perks and comforts. So, it was the well-treated amateurs who were to open at Lord's on that summer morning, and accordingly the gentlemen's openers, C.B. Fry and A.O. Jones, strode to the wicket, the latter sporting one of the finest moustaches in the game. Nottinghamshire's Arthur Jones had made his England debut the summer before, and had acquitted himself well with 3 wickets and respectable lower-order batting. There was to be no heroics on this morning, however, as a disappointing game for Jones began with him edging the bowling of Albert Trott for 9, sharply taken in the slips. The score stood at 26-1, as C.B. Fry awaited his next partner. If Grace was English cricket's first superstar, then Charles Burgess Fry possesses a good case to be counted as its second. A dashing all-round athlete, he briefly held the world long jump record while at Oxford and played at fullback for Southampton Football Club in an FA Cup final. Fry captured the public imagination with attacking batsmanship and a remarkable run of scoring in the county game. There was a certain poignancy in that it was Fry who took centre stage as Grace was preparing to depart, given that, according to Fry at least, Grace's biographer Richard Tomlinson has doubts as to the veracity of this story, he had unwittingly been the man who had called time on WG's test career. Grace had obviously liked what he'd seen of CB and assured his appointment to the newly established England selection committee after only his first home test match. In Fry's version of events, he arrived at the meeting to choose the side for that summer's second international, only to find the rest of the panel already in place. Before the new selector could sit down, Grace, his captain in the previous game, demanded he answer a question with a straight yes or no. Should Archie McLaren play in the next match? McLaren was a talented batsman who would improve most sides, and so Fry had no hesitation in answering in the affirmative. It was only after he sat down that he realised he had cast the deciding vote to include McLaren at the expense of Grace himself, bringing down the curtain on the Doctor's international career. Grace took the decision well, and certainly bore Fry no ill will. The greatest feats of Fry's career, including 6 centuries in successive first-class innings in 1901 and 7 centuries in successive innings a decade later, were soon to come, but by 1900 he had already established himself as one of England's foremost batting talents. In the 1898 first-class season, he had scored in excess of 1700 runs, reaching over 2300 runs in the following season, and was well on the way to nearly equaling that total in 1900. He would score over 3,000 in 1901. Indeed, the day after the gentleman's match finished at Lord's, Fry would travel to Hove to play for Sussex against Surrey, score 125 in the first innings and 229 in the second, the first of his 16 first-class double hundreds. On this morning, however, Fry struggled to find his familiar fluency with the bat. The Times' correspondent reported that he played with unusual caution and that his cricket was not up to his usual standards of excellence. Despite this, Fry posted the gentleman's second-highest score of the innings, a most respectable 63, and with the incoming batsman Charlie Townsend constructed the highest partnership of the day, putting on 73 runs for the second wicket. With the score on 99, Townsend was run out for 30. Reports do not tell us if either Fry or Townsend were at fault. And R.E. Foster joined Fry at the crease. Reginald Erskine Foster, better known as Tip, was another supreme all-round athlete. He is the only man to captain England at both cricket and football, but was destined to remain one of English cricket's greatest untapped talents. Foster had a solid defence and could play all around the wicket, but was particularly known for his brilliant offside play, possessing a flowing cover drive and a precise late cut. He was also an excellent slips fieldsman, one of the finest short slips in the country, according to Digby Jeffson, one of Foster's teammates in the Gentleman 11. Foster was making his first appearance in this prestigious fixture, and was doing so as the captain of Oxford University. He had made his first-class debut with Oxford in 1897, but it was not until 2 years later that he truly flowered as a cricketer and showed the sort of form that earned him his place in the gentleman's side. In 1899, he scored hundreds in both innings playing for Worcestershire in their inaugural first-class season. Uniquely, his brother Wilfred matched the feat in the same game. And, just a couple of weeks before his appearance for the gentleman at Lord's, had set a record for the highest score in the Oxford-Cambridge varsity match, notching 171. For his performances in 1900, he was named one of Wisden's 5 cricketers of the season, scoring close to 2,000 runs, which side of that mark depends on whose statistics you choose, at an average in excess of 50. Wisden remarked that we can recall no instance of an Oxford or Cambridge batsman making such an extraordinary advance in his last year at the university. The cricketing tome continued, many fine batsmen have done their best before leaving the universities, but Mr. Foster, assuming he can spare the time to keep up the game, is very likely only at the beginning of his real career. Foster's most remarkable feat, though, came in December of 1903. Representing England against the Australians in Sydney, he scored an unprecedented 287 runs. It was his first innings for his country and set a number of long-standing records. His score was the highest ever in a Test match, a record that stood until 1930, the highest score by an Englishman against Australia, only surpassed by Len Hutton's 364 in 1938, the highest score by any player in a Test match at the SCG, eventually overtaken by Michael Clarke in 2012, the highest by a non-Australian in Australia, beaten by Ross Taylor for New Zealand in 2015, and it remains the highest score by a debutant in Test matches. Sadly for the game of cricket, the caveat that Wisden had earlier noted regarding the progression of Foster's career was to be all too real, and opportunities to view his skills were to be severely limited. Foster was a businessman, and whether by necessity or desire, it was that part of his life that took precedence and greatly curtailed the time he could devote to sport. Despite his abundant talent, he only made 8 appearances for England, and with 1901 his only full county season, could only register 139 first-class appearances in an all-too-truncated career. His light shone brightly, yet briefly, and Tip Foster died in London, age 36, due to complications from diabetes. On this hot July morning, however, Foster's cricketing prowess was on full display, and after settling in during an opening half hour in which he remained scoreless, he set about the players' attack with gusto. He took a particular liking to the off-breaks of Walter Mead, using exceptional wrist speed to work him to the leg side boundary. C.B. Fry would later observe that Foster was quicker with his bat than any other cricketer he had seen, except perhaps his prolific Sussex colleague, Ranjit Singhji, which was high praise indeed. While Foster made light of the opposition attack, his teammates failed to do the same. After Fry was bowled by Wilfred Rhodes with a score on 127, there came somewhat of a procession of departing batsmen. Jack Mason was bowled for two, Surrey's Digby Jeffson trapped in front for nine, and the croucher, Gilbert Jessop, fell for 18, caught by wicketkeeper Dick Lilly running in front of the wicket. Soon after, Foster completed his half-century. With Captain Woods come and gone, and only three men yet to bat, it began to look as though Foster would be denied a deserved 100 on his debut. His hopes of a ton were raised when the Yorkshire all-rounder Ernest Smith joined him to put on 57 for the 8th wicket in just 40 minutes. However, when Smith departed, undone by an excellent catch by Rhodes at mid-off, and the Essex quick Charles Courtright played on shortly after, Foster was still short of three figures. Tip clearly had little faith in the staying power of the gentleman's number 11, wicketkeeper Henry Martin, and so began to hit out. He reached his 100 in the nick of time, as 2 runs later Martin fell to the left-arm bowling of John Gunn, finishing the innings. The gentleman had made 297, 102 of which had come from the bat of Foster. The players had bowled and fielded well, with only the brilliance of Foster and the tenacity of Fry posing them a problem. The total was respectable, but, as the Manchester Guardian noted, considering the number of dangerous run-getters in their team, it cannot be said that they did anything out of the common. Albert Trott had picked up 2 wickets for 43 runs, though the Manchester Guardian also noted that the figures gave no idea of the excellence of his work. John Gunn took 3 for 61, but it was Wilfred Rhodes who had done most of the damage, with a skilful display of bowling, posting a return of 4 for 93, including the valuable wicket of Fry. Yorkshire's Wilfred Rhodes remains one of English cricket's greatest all-rounders, and, until the arrival of the incomparable Garfield Sobers, possibly the best to play the game anywhere. Raw statistics never do the great cricketers justice, but in the case of Rhodes, they are worth reciting. During a first-class career spanning 32 years, he made 1,110 appearances, still a record, scored 39,969 runs with a high score of 267, took 4,204 wickets, another record that remains unbeaten, including 287 fifers and 68 10-wicket match hauls. He achieved the first-class double of 1,000 runs and 100 wickets in 16 seasons. In tests, he represented England 58 times, taking 127 wickets and scoring 2,325 runs. By bowing out from the international arena at the age of 52, he remains the oldest person to have played Test cricket, and is the only person who bowled at both titans of the game, W.G. Grace and Don Bradman. Rhodes began his career as a bowler, and his selection for the Players in July of 1900 was clearly as just that, batting at number 10 in both innings. And what a bowler he was. Rhythmic, unerringly accurate, thoughtful, left-arm spin. It was said that once Rhodes had got you out in a match, he would inevitably do so twice, as he would have worked out how. The great cricket writer Neville Carders wrote of Rhodes, "Flight was his secret, flight and the curving line. Every ball a decoy, a spy sent out to get the lie of the land. Some ball simple, some complex, some easy, some difficult. And one of them, ah, which? The master ball." Bradman, who had faced Rhodes late in the Yorkshireman's career, recalled the economy of his action, the great accuracy and cunning of his bowling. Middlesex batsman Patsy Hendren was more direct. Rhodes, he said, was as full of tricks as a whole zoo of monkeys. In the second Ashes test of the 1903-04 tour, as Rhodes was on his way to taking 15 wickets, the great Australian batsman Victor Trumper was heard to remark, "Please, Wilfred, give me a minute's rest." His batting developed later, but when it did, he became a true all-rounder, moving up the order to finally open the batting for England. In the Melbourne test of 1912, he and his opening partner, Jack Hobbs, put on a record stand of 323, setting up an innings victory for the English. Rhodes even managed to outscore his illustrious partner, posting 179 to Hobbs's 178. It is noticeable and a pity that for all of Rhodes's undoubted brilliance, he was, in his time, respected and admired rather than celebrated in the way that Grace or Fry were. There is undoubtedly, once more, a class element to this. Amateurs such as they were seen as the dashing, carefree young men of the game, whereas the professionals were there to labour. In line with this mindset, batting exploits were celebrated, and occasionally financially rewarded, much more than any feat performed by the bowlers, who were too often seen as the team's workmen. Rhodes was also not the most outgoing character, was publicly viewed as rather dour and unsmiling, and this perception also contributed to his not receiving the sort of widespread affection afforded some of his peers. His performance on this July day, though, was certainly appreciated, and had helped make batting difficult for anyone other than Foster. Indeed, the players could even have been justified in feeling that, given their quality in the field, they had allowed the gentlemen a few too many runs. The professionals would still need to bat well, though, to reach parity. Things started smoothly for the players with their diminutive captain Abel and the veteran Albert Ward, a Yorkshireman who plied his trade for Lancashire, putting on a partnership of 48 runs before Ward edged one to the slips off the bowling of Mason. Only 13 more runs were added before the players found themselves 2 wickets down when Tom Hayward failed to keep out one of Gilbert Jessop's quick deliveries and departed for 8. Jessop had found his rhythm and aggression and threatened to have more players back in the pavilion before the close of play. Some dogged resistance by Abel and his new partner, the similarly height-restricted Willie Quaife, saw them through the remaining overs. When the umpires finally called time, the players had reached 66 for 2, leaving the game evenly balanced. Tuesday, 17th of July, 1900. If the players' plan was to bat deep into the day before releasing Rhodes, Trott and Gunn at the opposition's batsmen, they quickly found that the gentleman's own bowling trio of Mason, Jessop and Courtright had other ideas. The resuming batsmen barely had time to adjust to the morning heat before they were back in the changing room. Abel added a solitary run to his overnight score before being accounted for by a Yorker from the speedy Jessop, and Quaife fared little better in departing to the same bowler for 9. Matters were not about to improve for the professionals, and Abel's 30 was to be their highest score. Jack Brown, Herbert Carpenter and Dick Lilly all reached double figures, though not much more, and the rest perished while still in single digits. The players had been skittled for 136, some 161 runs behind the gentlemen. That the players had failed to cope with either the bowling or the conditions shed even greater light on the brilliance of Tip Foster's innings the day before. It also said much about the difference in the bowling attacks employed by the two teams. The gentlemen's success in the field during the first innings had rested on a group of quick bowlers. Mason was classed as fast medium, Jessop genuinely quick, and Charles Courtright was held by many as the fastest bowler the game had ever produced. Sammy Woods, himself no slouch in his day, said Courtright was the fastest, but not the best, I ever saw. And fellow quick Ernest Jones, when asked who was the most rapid, responded, Courtright of Essex, and I'm next. These pacemen found they could extract more from the pitch, and consequently caused the batsmen far greater problems than the players' attack, which, while skilful, was based on medium pace and spin. While the Times newspaper conveyed the impression that the gentlemen had been helped somewhat by the pitch during the second day, most observers and participants argued that the surface was more than playable. Wisden reported that there had been nothing the matter with it. The correspondent from the Daily News also absolved the surface from much of the blame and reported the players' batsmen concurred that it was almost perfect. Bowler Gilbert Jessop described the wicket as plumb, and well he might, as the track clearly had given some assistance to him and the other gentlemen quicks. Both Bobby Abel and Willie Quaife had been hit by the bowling of Jessop late on the first evening. Abel several times, one delivery was said to nearly take away the peak of his cap, and was still hobbling when he resumed the next morning. Abel received little sympathy from the assembled crowd, many of whom reportedly looked on the affair as a huge joke. Possibly to protect his fast bowlers from the heat of the day, perhaps because Sammy Woods was keen for his gentlemen to push home or even showcase their advantage with the undoubted batting talents at their disposal, the follow-on was not enforced, and the amateurs were to bat again. As they took the field for the second time, it was fair to say that things were not looking good for the professionals. The gentlemen, buoyed by their commanding lead, approached their second innings with an attacking intent. Runs started to come quickly, but the risks were evident as a couple of wickets fell before 50 were on the board. Jones castled by Rhodes for 5, and Charlie Townsend succumbing to the same fate for a quickfire 22. Still, at 43 for 2, the lead stood in excess of 200, and the gentlemen saw no need to slow down. However, as with the previous day's play, C.B. Fry was uncharacteristically restrained, seeming to struggle to find his usual freedom. He instead took the role of anchor to another outstanding knock by Reginald Erskine Foster. Foster took a little time to settle into his innings, but once set he laid into the players bowling with brio, scoring 136 out of a partnership of 195 with Fry in an hour and 40 minutes. The first time in the history of the fixture that any batsman had scored a century in both innings. He also joined W.G. Grace as the only people to have achieved this feat in 3 separate matches. No others, at this point, had managed it more than once. Once he reached his ton, Tip Foster cut loose, flashing his blade at almost every ball. When he was finally caught at long on, he left the field to a thunderous ovation. If his first innings had been excellent, came the report from Lords, the second had been brilliant. It was a near-fatal blow to any hopes the players may have had at the start of the morning's play, as Foster departed with the lead a tick under 400, and still 7 batsmen yet to come. The mood of the professionals would not have been improved by the knowledge that John Gunn had missed a catchable chance off the Centurion when he was on 40. Still, the players' attack persevered, and with the gentlemen, under instruction from their captain Woods, showing no intention of reining in their daring batsmanship, or in the words of the correspondent from the Manchester Guardian, their indiscriminate hitting, wickets started to fall. Fry unfortunately hit his own stumps, having made 72. Trott picked up the wicket of Mason for 27 and bowled Jessop for a 6-ball 18. Woods had told the big-hitting Jessop he had 5 minutes to get his runs. After Albert Ward dismissed the gentleman's captain for a duck, the tail wagged a little, but Trott finally saw off the last 3 men with the score at 339, a lead of exactly 500. The gentlemen had made their total in little over 3 hours, rattling along at a rate of more than 5 runs an over. The players' bowling attack had every right to feel a little bruised by the mauling at the hands of Foster and his fellow gentlemen. Albert Trott, who had seen his efforts punished at a rate of almost 7 runs an over, could, though, take solace in the fact that he had also taken most of the wickets to fall, finishing with 6 for 142. The Hall had pushed his wickets tally for the season above 100. Albert Edwin Trott, an Australian from Melbourne, who, like Sammy Woods, had the distinction of playing Test cricket for both Australia and England, is in some ways a curious figure in cricketing history. A highly talented round-arm bowler with good variations and a solid batsman, he was rarely given the credit or international recognition his undoubted skills deserved. Picked by Australia for the last 3 tests of their home Ashes series in 1894-5, Trott scored over 200 runs, finishing the series with an average in excess of 100. And took 8 wickets at an average of 21. In the penultimate test, he was denied any chance to add to his wicket-taking tally by swift England collapses in both innings, leaving him unused as a bowler. Despite this more than respectable performance, however, Trott found himself omitted from the Australian touring party to England the following summer. In lieu of an Ashes series to keep him occupied, Trott paid for his own passage to England and eventually found a home as a professional for Middlesex. He represented the county with distinction until 1910, racking up a career first-class record of over 10,000 runs and 1,674 wickets. His greatest year was in 1899, where, in addition to becoming the only man to ever hit the ball over the Lord's Pavilion, he scored in excess of 1,000 runs and took 239 wickets. The previous summer he had been selected for England and played 2 tests in the South African tour, claiming 17 scalps. While he had another productive season in 1900, it wasn't long before weight gain and a fondness for sharing ales with spectators while fielding quickly reduced his effectiveness. He continued playing for his county for the rest of the decade, achieving the remarkable feat of 4 wickets in an over, along with another hat-trick in his 1907 benefit game. Unfortunately, this caused the game to be ended extremely early, denying him much of the money that would have come from spectators yet to arrive. On retiring from county cricket in 1910, Albert became an umpire, but falling into poverty and affected by illness and depression, in 1914 he took his own life. On that sweltering afternoon, Albert Trott and his teammates faced an uphill battle to save the game. Facing the task of scoring a highly unlikely 501 runs to win, the only slightly more possible route to salvation appeared to lie in batting out the remaining overs of the day and finding some way to resist throughout the next to salvage a draw. If a gentleman's victory seemed highly probable at the change of innings, it looked a nailed-on certainty when the players lost their first wicket, Ward caught off the bowling of Jessop for just 4. Adding to the players' difficulties was the fact that their number 3 in the first innings, Tom Haywood, was unable to take his place at the crease due to having been so affected by the heat earlier in the day that he'd been forced to leave the field. Even so, Brown and Quaife batted gamely for the remaining overs, and when time was called, the players stood at 44 for 1, some 456 runs behind. Wednesday, 18th of July, 1900. With play scheduled to run on until 6:30 in the evening, the players' chance of surviving against the 5 quick bowlers at the gentleman's disposal looked remote. A healthy crowd gathered in anticipation of a splendid amateur win, and all looked to be following the script when a Willie Quaife was trapped LBW by Jones for 29. 81 for 2, 419 runs behind. With Haywood still unavailable, skipper Bobby Able joined Jack Brown in the middle. Brown, a short, stocky Yorkshireman whose career and life were both cut woefully short by heart problems, was a pugnacious batsman, most comfortable on the back foot. Strong against the short ball, especially around off stump, he found the conditions and the bowling now very much to his liking. The gentleman's quicks may have been able to exploit what life was in the wicket on the morning of day 2, but no strip could have possibly stood up to such unrelenting heat, and consequently, by day 3, had been baked into a hard, flat batsman's track. Though wicketkeeper Dick Lilly recalled that it also had worn a little, and so would have given some help to the bowlers. Furthermore, to Brown's undoubted approval, the bowlers soon began to tire and drop the ball too short, the paceman's cause not helped by the fact that the MCC had changed the laws at the start of the season, increasing the balls delivered in an over from 5 to 6, adding to their already arduous workload. With Brown employing his favourite late cut and Abel strong on the leg side against the short ball, the players finally began to see some success with the bat. The pair dominated the amateur's attack until, shortly after lunch, Abel, only 2 frustrating runs short of a century, let his eagerness get the better of him, and attempting a big pull off a short pitch ball from Jessop, was easily caught at forward short leg. The player's captain had gone, yet his and Brown's efforts ensured that the balance of the game had certainly begun to fidget, if not yet entirely shift. 246 for 3, 254 runs behind. Tom Haywood, having finally recovered from his problems of the day before, made his way to the crease. This was an important moment in the game. Undoubtedly, the match was still the gentleman's to lose. While the professionals had made more than an encouraging start, they were still a long way behind, and a couple of wickets would all but see them off. However, if Haywood and Brown could continue the flood of runs, then well, who knew? Perhaps inevitably, the pair could not manage the scoring pace of the morning, but still managed to settle into a productive partnership and began to frustrate the gentleman's bowlers once more. The pitch remained true, and the batsman's timing immaculate. Brown soon reached his century, and late in the afternoon, when he finally succumbed, caught in the slips off the bowling of Smith, he had been at the crease for just under 5 hours for a handsome 163, containing 29 fours. 348 for 4, 152 runs behind. The impossible task now looked distinctly possible. 152 runs, more than the professionals had made in their first innings, but with batting to come, favourable conditions, and a tiring bowling attack, few would have staked their reputation on the winning target not being reached. It was still no easy task, and when Herbert Carpenter was bowled by Woods for 9, the players' changing room would have been forgiven for experiencing a strong case of the jitters. Dick Lilly arrived clearly looking to take the game away from the gentleman, and to do so quickly. Relying on his confident drive, the player's wicketkeeper made a rapid 30 before cutting a ball from Mason into his stumps. Another one gone. 448 for 6, 52 runs behind. while the likes of Rhodes, Gunn and Trott were no fools of the bat. Indeed, as we have seen, Trott had a proven record, as did Gunn, and Rhodes would go on to have a distinguished batting career. They had been picked for their bowling prowess, and so all eyes were fixed on Hayward to see the players home. The tension ratcheted further then, when only 19 runs after Trott had joined him at the crease, Hayward was gone, caught by the wicketkeeper standing back to Courtright for a fine 111. Nelson had struck again. 469 for 7, 31 runs behind. Now firmly into the tail, the gentlemen must have sensed their chance to snatch victory back once more. For the players, the 32 runs needed for victory would have seemed a mountain. Trott and Gunn started to eat gradually into the lead, every run lessening the tension, every full stroke tightening it still. The end was almost in sight when Gunn received a thunderbolt from the arm of Courtright and departed with his stumps in a mess. 485 for 8, 15 runs behind. Rhodes was the penultimate man for the players, and while it may not have been appreciated at that stage of his career, how fortunate for his team to have a man of such natural batting ability coming in so low down the order. Certainly no number 10, and so it proved. For all the tension of that late afternoon, on the stroke of 6:30, the pairing of Albert Trott and Wilfred Rhodes had knocked off the remaining deficit to leave the scores level. This was the moment when the umpires should have called time, drawn stumps, and seen the teams shake hands on a momentous draw. The gentleman's captain, Sammy Woods, who felt that draws were no good except for bathing, had other ideas, and convinced the umpires to allow him to take the ball himself for another over. While Woods may have harboured ideas of taking the remaining two wickets to claim the tie, it was unlikely, and on the fifth ball of the extra over, Rhodes saw the players home with little fuss. With little fuss, but amongst scenes of great excitement and some controversy. For all those lucky enough to be present at Lord's on that day knew they had witnessed something very special. The result itself, the chasing down of over 500 runs in a final innings, only the second time a team had achieved that feat, was remarkable enough. However, the match was so much more than an unlikely victory. Those spectators over three sweltering days were treated to 1,274 runs scored, in often high style, off 372 overs. They had witnessed some of the finest players to grace a cricketing field of play, from the lightning-quick bowling of Courtright and his colleagues, the skill and tenacity of the slower deliveries of Rhodes, Trott and Gunn, a century in each innings from the brilliant Foster, who, along with Fry, hardly deserved to be on the losing team, and finally the winning contribution of hundreds from Brown and Hayward. It was a feast of cricket. Not everyone was delighted with the outcome. The gentleman's captain, Sammy Woods, came in for criticism for his tactics. Not only had he failed to enforce the follow-on during the second day, but his insistence that his team hit out during the second innings drew disapproval, most noticeably from Wisden, which reasoned that the decision had allowed the players their chance at victory. This has to be seen as harsh. Wood's aggressive tactics had given the gentleman what should have been an unassailable lead, with more than enough time left in the game to bowl the players out for a second time. For Wisden, though, that was all very well, but the fact remained that there was only one possible way by which the gentleman could lose the match, and that their captain adopted it. It is, the report counselled, a wholesome rule to take nothing for granted in cricket, and to throw nothing away except under stress of absolute necessity. Somewhat grudgingly, Wisden did concede that, though the gentlemen suffered a feat to the risk of which they need not have been exposed, the public profited, the cricket on the last day being quite a marvel of sustained interest. Others were far more supportive of Wood's approach. The Daily News praised Woods for his great effort to win the game. The players' wicketkeeper Lilly saw it as a straightforward choice, as there could be no possible suggestion at the time that any risk was being run in adopting this course. One of Woods's gentleman colleagues that day, Gilbert Jessop, argued for the value of allowing the bowlers a crack at the opposition late on the second evening. Furthermore, he countered, it had only been by giving the players a sniff of the hope of victory that they prevented them from grinding out the final day on a flat pitch for a draw. According to Jessop, what might so easily have resulted in a long, drawn-out match with a tame finish had been converted by Sam's enterprise into a most stirring game. As for Woods, Jessop finished, a more inspiring leader I could not wish for. the issue of the extra over after the scheduled close of play that allowed the players to snatch victory brought with it praise, criticism and confusion in equal measure. Sir Pelham Warner, writing about the match some years later, took the umpires to task for not drawing stumps at 6:30. The extra over, he argued, was too magnanimous. What were the umpires about? Dick Lilly, for whom Woods' action allowed him to emerge on the winning side, he was fulsome in his praise of that good spirit of sportsmanship so characteristic of him. The Daily News report, however, argued that carrying on for a result was quite normal in matches of this sort. The correspondent for the Times newspaper seemed unaware of the dispute and simply assumed that play had been scheduled to continue until 7. Woods was fully aware of the controversy caused by both his approach in the second innings and the extra over he allowed. Of course, he noted, next day, and the day before in the pavilion, my action was very much criticised. For him, however, there was no issue. Well, had I left my side to bat until time on the second day, and not have given the players a chance of getting the runs, a pretty day's play would have resulted. To win or lose a game is the game, and not to bother about first and second innings wins or the championship. It was, one must say, a traditionally amateur approach. Another line of complaint concerned Woods' use of his bowling attack, with the argument that Courtright could have been asked to bowl more than the 18 overs he was given, perhaps unsurprising for a fast bowler given the heat, and that when Woods turned to his slower alternatives, he gave Charlie Townsend, a very good leg break bowler, only 2 overs, while giving Arthur Jones 23. Pelham Warner recalled that, in his view, Woods' captaincy on that day was not up to its usual standard. Sammy Woods would not captain the gentleman again. In any case, whatever the decisions made by Woods on the final day, the abiding memory of this fixture must remain the exceptional achievement of the players. Conditions may have been favourable for batting on that last day, but the difficulty of scoring in excess of 500 runs against bowlers of the quality of Courtright, Mason, Jessop and Jeffson should never be underestimated. The gentlemen versus players fixture now seems a curious anachronism, though English cricket's attachment to the British class system has hardly disappeared, and since its stumps were drawn for the final time in 1962, the match gains little attention in wistful glances back through cricketing time. It did, though, for a while, not only encapsulate the social distinctions so embedded in the game of cricket, it also captured the public's attention and provided some glorious moments for some wonderful players. Cricket and England Through 5 Matches is a production of Cricket Stuff. Find us at cricketstuff.blog or contact us on Twitter @cricket_stuff.